Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A warning for listeners. This podcast features original audio from 9/11, plus recreations of the day. We feel it's important history to hear, but it can also be disturbing. For those in Lower Manhattan on Tuesday, September 11th, there's one haunting image almost everyone mentions besides the burning buildings. The hospitals. The empty hospitals. In the minutes and hours after the attack, hospitals across the New York area readied themselves. They were preparing to receive and treat massive casualties from the attack, converting cafeterias and surgical wards into overflow ERs and triage areas. All of the doctors, nurses, and administrators made the same instant calculation. The large-scale destruction would surely result in thousands or even tens of thousands of injuries. And it wasn't just in New York. I was in Boston on 9/11, a reporter for my college newspaper, and I remember hearing rumors all afternoon about how the local hospitals were ready to receive injured patients from New York, which would be surely overrun with the grievous injuries and trauma cases. I spoke with my editors about going out to Hanscom Air Force Base, where the injured were supposed to start arriving. Up and down the East Coast, it would be all hands on deck. But in the end, there was no need. Throughout the day, some did seek treatment. Manhattan residents and first responders, but the arriving patients only ever amounted to a trickle. Not the feared flood. Outside the hospitals, it became a haunting scene. Rows of stretchers, lines of doctors and nurses, all waiting anxiously, desperately, for patients who never came. The truth was that, considering the scope of the devastation, there just weren't that many injuries, at least not serious ones. The collapse of the Twin Towers was a unique, grievous, destructive event. You either lived or died. And as the frantic rescue efforts began that afternoon at the site first called the Pile, rescuers thought there wasn't anybody to save. But they were wrong. There were, in the end, 18 people rescued from the collapse. Just 18. Almost all of them were with FDNY Captain Jay Jonas of Ladder 6. Jonas and his team had climbed the North Tower Stairwell B to help evacuate people trapped by the attack. You originally heard from him in the first episode of the series.
We never did make it out of the building, which is something that people have a hard time wrapping their heads around.
And of those 18 survivors, only two were pulled from underneath the towers. They were Port Authority Police Department Officer Will Jimeno and his sergeant, John McLaughlin. Today, Jonas and Jimeno will tell us about the most horrific moment of their lives and what they learned about themselves when the worst thing that they could ever imagine actually happened. I'm Garrett Graff, a journalist, historian, and author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Only Plane in the Sky. I've spent much of the last two decades studying and reporting on 9/11 and how it changed our world. But today, on the 20th anniversary of the attacks, it's clear that many people still don't know the full story. From Longlead and Goat Rodeo, this is Long Shadow, a podcast about the enduring mysteries and lingering questions of 9/11. On today's episode, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to hear the most hopeful stories I've heard from amid the tragedy and rubble of 9/11. The stories of two people who had the World Trade Center fall on top of them, and how they stood back up.
You're going to have to get them down to the elevator. There's about 10 to 15 people coming down to you.
FDNY firefighter Jay Jonas knew it in his gut. The building that he was in, the North Tower of the World Trade Center, was about to collapse. It was just before 10:30 on the morning of September 11th, 2001.
This is the scary part of the day for me, to be honest. Now, the sister building to the one I was in got hit after my building had collapsed. So it didn't take much of a calculation to realize that we're going to be lucky if we get out of here alive. So I'm terrified. But I'm trying to keep it together as best I could to be a solid leader for my men.
Jonas was the captain of Ladder 6, a firehouse in Manhattan. He and five other members of his team were slowly making their way down stairwell B, the central stairwell of the North Tower. They were escorting a 59-year-old woman named Josephine Harris, a bookkeeper for the Port Authority who worked on the 73rd floor. Harris had made her way down nearly 60 flights of stairs with a group of other survivors, but she was recovering from a car accident and her legs were weak. Ultimately, she got left behind. That's when Ladder 6 found her, scared and alone in the stairwell. They went together, slowly, step by step, whispering motivational messages in her ear. "Keep going, you're almost there," they told her. "Let's get you home to see your family, Josephine." Harris died in 2011, but she earlier spoke to NBC's Stone Phillips.
"Was it hard going down the stairs?"
"Yes, very."
"Step by step, one stair at a time, 1 foot at a time."
I'm putting 1 foot, 1 foot. Instead of going step by step, I'm going like one, one.
So we continue down the stairs. And as we're going down the stairs, I hear a radio transmission between Chief Hayden and Captain Patty Brown. Chief Hayden goes over the radio, says, "Command post to Ladder 3, command post to Ladder 3, get out of the building." And Patty Brown got on the radio, says, "This is the officer of Ladder Company 3. I refuse the order. I'm on the 44th floor. I got too many burned people with me. I'm not leaving them." One of the most dramatic things I've ever heard. You know, I've never heard that before or since. And Captain Patty Brown, all the guys from Ladder 3, and all the people they were treating were killed in the collapse. We continued down the stairs. I ran into a man named Faustino Apostle, his name was Faust for short. And he was a chief's aide to the 2nd Battalion. And his chief was Bill McGovern, and he was supervising some sort of rescue effort on that floor. And I looked at Faust, and I said, "Hey, Faust, let's go. It's time to go." And he said, "That's okay, Jay. I'm waiting for the chief." The chief was his partner, and he wasn't going to leave his partner. Both he and the chief were killed in the collapse. We made it to the 12th floor, and I saw a man I knew. This guy's name was Mike Warcola. He was a lieutenant in Ladder 5. And he and two of his men were working on a civilian who looked like was having chest pains in the stairway. And I addressed Mike. I said, "Mike, Let's go. It's time to go. He said, that's all right, Jay. You have your civilian. I have mine. We'll be right behind you. I said something like, well, don't wait too long. And we continued down the stairs. People have asked me about my decision to stop and save Josephine, even though we were under the most extreme conditions you could possibly imagine. And I just would respond to them. And I said, well, that's what we went there to do. We went there to save somebody's life. It's not like we went to there for the World Trade Center experience. We went there to save somebody's life. And, you know, that's what firemen do.
Jonas, the team, and Harris continue down the stairs. Once they made it toward the building's fourth floor, Jonas started to have a glimmer of hope. They might just make it out.
We got to the fourth floor, and suddenly Josephine Harris falls to the floor, and she starts yelling at us to leave her alone.
She was exhausted, hurt, and felt like she was slowing them down.
You know, leave me alone, don't touch me. You know, I don't want to leave here, which was very frustrating at the time because we just carried her down from the 20th floor and now she's saying don't touch her and to leave her alone.
So Jonas started desperately looking for a chair, something, anything to carry Harris down the rest of the way. He was running across the floor but couldn't find anything, just big, useless pieces of mechanical equipment. So he ran back to stairwell B.
I got about 3 or 4 feet away from the stairway door, and it starts. The collapse of the North Tower with us still inside. The collapse was a series of different sensations. The two towers collapsed in two different ways. My tower collapsed from the top down in what we call a pancake collapse. And, you know, one floor would hit, another floor would hit, another floor, like that. Every time a floor would hit another floor, it would make a noise, and you'd feel tremendous vibration. But these buildings are 1,350 feet in height, and so the collapse started that far away. And so as the collapse got closer and closer, the vibration and the noise would get louder and the vibration more violent. You would also hear a sound of twisting steel as the collapse is getting closer. Whatever air was in the building was being compressed. So it created tornado-like winds within the stairway.
The gust of compressed wind lifted Harris off her feet.
It knocked me down. It knocked one of the firemen down. And I remember also I was holding on to a fireman's boot, his leg, like for dear life.
It's so strong that Mike Tillerman, Matt Kamarowski, was picked up and thrown down two flights of stairs. He was waiting for me on the fourth floor landing. And inside this window was peppered with debris. And we kept getting pummeled by debris as the building is getting demolished as it's coming down.
It took 10 seconds for each of the towers to fall that day. A violence of unimaginable and devastating force as each floor, a full acre of concrete and office space, pancaked down onto the next.
Well, you know, we kept waiting, I kept waiting, speaking for the other guys, kept waiting for that big beam or that big piece of concrete to come and get us. Remember that scary feeling I told you I had after the South Tower collapsed? Once the collapse of our building started, the fear went away. You know, it was that kind of thing that, well, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and I was just going to deal with it.
The stairwell they were in turned pitch black as smoke, dust, and debris filled the air and coated them head to toe. But slowly the rumbling faded, the debris around them settled, and the smoke started to clear. They unclenched their eyes, stunned that they were still alive and largely unhurt. Captain Jonas tried to make sense of the scene around him.
And I'm coughing and gagging. I got debris in my mouth, ears, nose, eyes. And I'm hearing other people coughing and gagging.
And the stuff is just hanging everywhere. But you can see the light coming in. You see this big beam, I guess that's what you call it. Just torn up like paper. And this is a building. And we're sitting there for a long time. Very long time.
While Ladder 6 and Josephine Harris miraculously survived the collapse of the North Tower, Will Jimeno was just yards away, already buried in the rubble from the collapse of the first crash at the South Tower. Jimeno was a Port Authority police officer on September 11th, and he was new to the job. He'd graduated from the PAPD Academy in a ceremony actually held at the World Trade Center earlier that year in January.
So as Port Authority police officers, you know, we protect and serve all the infrastructure in the New York metro area, New York, New Jersey. And we are responsible for protecting the World Trade Center, the three major airports, the bridges, the tunnels, the bus terminal, the PATH train.
Jimeno, that morning, had been standing post uptown at the Port Authority bus terminal when the plane hit. Then he was dispatched to the Trade Center. The second plane hit while Jimeno was en route, and he never even knew it happened. Because Jimeno was fresh out of the academy, he was assigned to help the rescue efforts. PAPD officers are cross-trained in firefighting, and since he was so new, he still remembered how to use the firefighting breathing equipment. They were gathering gear in the basement underneath the tower when it collapsed at 9:59 a.m. Jimeno was with four other PAPD officers when it fell. Once the rubble settled around them, he was pinned under a huge piece of concrete in searing pain.
It felt like probably 100 Chevy Suburbans on my left side. All I had was a little bit of use of my left arm. My right arm was open because the concrete just came right below my police shield and then worked its way down over my left leg.
The officers took stock of their situation. Two of the team, Christopher Amoroso and Antonio Rodriguez, were gone. But three had survived. Jimeno, his friend and fellow officer Dominic Pizzullo, and their sergeant John McLaughlin. Jimeno tried to communicate on his radio using the code for an officer in distress. 813, 813, officers down. Nothing. Jimeno and the Sarge were pinned tightly under debris, but Pizzullo was able to shimmy out of some rubble.
So he gets over and he looks up. And I tell everybody, you know, we're all human beings. No matter how tough you think you are, what department you're with or what military group you're with, we're all human. And Dominic looked up and he saw the hole. And he said, Sarge, I think I can go out that hole and get help. And Sergeant McLaughlin said, if you leave us, you'll never find us again. There's a debris field up there. Dominic said, you know, Will, I can go out and get help. And I said, Dom, but if you leave us, Sergeant McLaughlin's saying, you know, you're not going to find us. And he said, you know, I got a wife and kids at home. I said, I got a wife and kids at home, and my wife's pregnant with one on the way. And there was a real serious conversation there. You know, he did what I felt was the right thing, and I think that I would have done. He turned around and he said, I'm going to get you out.
Then, as Pizzullo tried to pull Jimeno from the concrete, they felt the neighboring North Tower fall. The trapped officers literally never knew what hit them. They had no idea the towers above had collapsed. McLaughlin speculated that perhaps a car bomb had exploded outside. The the rubble around them started to move. Some fell on Sergeant McLaughlin, who was now yelling in pain. Another piece of debris slammed into Pizzullo. Now he was in bad shape, laying just feet from Jimeno as blood poured out of his mouth.
He goes, "I'm dying, Willie. Please don't ever forget that I died trying to save you guys. I said, Tom, I would never let anybody forget this." At that point, he actually asked Sergeant McLaughlin for a break, a 3-8, which is Port Authority code for a break. And Sergeant McLaughlin stopped his yelling and actually said, "Yeah, you can have a 3-8.
Pizzullo used the last of his strength to hoist his service weapon above his head. He aimed it at a tiny hole where they could see the blue sky over Manhattan. And he fired a single round in an attempt to let first responders know where they were. Then he slumped over and died. The PAPD officers were trapped, unable to move, buried under the remnants of 220 stories of the World Trade Center. No one knew they were there, and no one was coming to rescue them. About 60 yards away, the dust and debris were starting to settle around Jay Jonas and the other firefighters of Ladder 6, and the civilian they'd stopped to rescue, Josephine Harris. Amazingly, the North Tower Stairwell B, or at least a portion of it, had survived. They didn't know it at the time, but Jay Jonas and his fellow survivors weren't actually buried underneath the rubble. They were on top of it, on one of the last pieces of the building still standing. They also didn't realize, though, that parts of the stairwell above them weren't intact. But they did know, at least for the moment, that they had survived.
So I gave out a roll call to see who was still there. And all my people were accounted for. And I said, "What about the woman?" I didn't know her name yet. And Billy Butler said, "Yes, she's right here. She's right in my face." So right away, we're thinking, okay, let's dust ourselves off and continue down the stairs.
But that way was blocked. Then they heard a Mayday message. It was another fireman, Mike Warcola, one of the guys Jonas had seen earlier helping with the evacuation.
And a Mayday message is essentially a fireman is in distress. And it came over, "Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. This is the officer of Ladder 5. I'm on the 12th floor B stairway. I'm trapped and I'm hurt bad." And so I started climbing the B stairway to get to him. And, you know, the stairway is there, but it's twisted. It's got holes in it. It's rubble filled. But I climbed and I made it to the 5th floor. And Mike Warcola transmits a second Mayday. And I keep climbing. And I got to the half landing between the 5th and the 6th floor. The debris is now so heavy I can't move it. I can't pull it out of the way, push it out of the way. Mike Warcola sends out a third Mayday. This time he's even more distraught. And I just said, "I'm sorry, Mike, I can't help you." And that's the last we heard from Mike Warcola. This was to be his last tour in the New York City Fire Department. He was scheduled to retire on September 12th. So this was his last day.
I featured the story of Jay Jonas and the survivors of Stairwell B in my book, The Only Plane in the Sky. This next detail is one of the most revealing I came across in all of my research. It tells you so much about the mentality and the mindset, the run-of-the-mill, everyday heroism of the first responders that day. As they took stock of their situation, Captain Jonas resisted putting out his own Mayday message. A Mayday message, like the one he'd heard from Warcola, is as bad as it gets. It's the type of emergency message you may go through your entire career never hearing come over the radio. And that day, buried inside the World Trade Center, Jay Jonas didn't want to put out his own Mayday call. He figured there were others in real trouble, and he didn't want to bother anybody. He was the rescuer. At least, that's what his mentality had been before that moment.
You usually were on the other end of this equation, that where somebody else is in trouble, we go in, we save the day, we get them out. Now, we're hurt. We're in trouble.
Jonas made his way back to the rest of the team in the remains of the fourth floor landing. They were trapped, with nowhere to go, above or below.
You know, I could see in my guys that they were, you know, they were in a bad way mentally, that, you know, how are we going to get out of here? Are we going to die here? You know, God spoke to them. I said, listen, if we survive this, we're not only going home, we're going home today. And I'm sure they thought that I got hit in the head or something by making that statement. But eventually I got buy-in. You know, it was kind of like a leadership moment for me that I was able to uplift them and got them thinking that we're going home. We're going home today. And which greatly improved the attitude in the stairway.
Finally, the firefighters stuck in stairwell B started firing off their own mayday.
All right, I'm on my way up, Wario.
They hoped that first responders outside might be able to find them. Jonas connected with one over the radio. He was asked for a landmark, something to help figure out where they were.
They're trying to orient themselves because all landmarks were gone. You had guys who worked down there for years, and you put them in the middle of the pile and they get lost. You know, with the smoke and the debris coming up. But they were trying to orient themselves. At one point, somebody asked, "Where's the North Tower?" And I was like, "You don't know where the North Tower is. It's the big building on the corner." You know, it's like, so that was a little discouraging when I heard that.
Jonas and the rest of Ladder 6 patiently waited while first responders outside sifted through the rubble. They stayed focused on Josephine Harris, the woman they were trying to rescue.
She remained calm the whole time. There was only one time where she lost her composure. And there was an explosion that happened outside the stairway, and it created a secondary collapse. And pieces of debris were falling down on top of us. And my chauffeur, my senior member, Mike Meldrum, rolled his body onto hers and shielded her body with his. And Sal D'Agostino, after it stopped, took his coat off, and his fireman's coat, and put it over her. And he told her, he says, "Listen, nothing is going to happen to you. As long as we're here, nothing's going to happen to you." Which emboldened her and made her stronger. She became our reason for being in the World Trade Center. You know, we were going to save somebody's life and we're going to save hers. You know, we're trapped for hours now. And the smoke and dust finally cleared enough outside that a ray of sunshine finally hit the stairway. And all of a sudden, a ray of sunshine came in the stairway. And you looked up and you could see a little sliver of blue sky. And I just looked at my guys. I said, "Guys, we used to be have 106 floors over our heads. Now I see a sliver of blue sky." And I said, "I think we're on top of the World Trade Center."
Off in the distance, below their stairwell, the team could see some space where a fireman was looking through the rubble. "That's our way out," Jonas thought. They shouted to get his attention and then tied a rope around one of the other officers trapped in the stairwell. He slowly worked his way down the damaged stairwell and connected with the first responders outside. Rescuers got a basket stretcher up to the survivors. They put Harris in it. Here she is again, speaking to NBC.
"They strapped me in. And we started that long journey. And I guess they took me across those beams in that basket. It was a rough ride.
So they carried you out.
Yeah. When I took that scarf or whatever it was that was on my face that they had covered my face with, and I saw the sky. It was a beautiful blue sky. And that meant that I had made it. I was safe. I had been blessed. They brought me to safety like they said they would. They brought me from my tomb to safety.
When Jonas later left the stairwell, he was shocked. The Twin Towers were now only mountains of burning debris. The Manhattan he had worked in for decades looked like a war zone. Once out of the rubble, Jonas went to check on the other firemen getting medical attention. He met a firefighter who was asking about Engine 4, another FDNY unit where the firefighter's son worked.
That statement hit me. This is how horrible this event was going to be. A lot of guys get into the fire service because they know somebody, or their father or their grandfather or a brother was in the fire service, and they talked them into it. And that you're going to have fathers digging for their sons. You're going to have sons digging for their fathers. And brothers digging for brothers. And that's what happened. That's exactly what happened.
Jonas thought back on all those firefighters he had passed in the North Tower before it collapsed. The ones who had stopped to help people evacuate. The ones who turned down commands to leave the building so that they could save or comfort one more life.
You know, you got to think about the people, who are no longer with us. That'll always be. Because they were taking away from us, they were murdered. It was taking away from us senselessly. But as time goes on, I remember what they were doing before those buildings collapsed. And it was so heroic, what they were doing. And I tend to think of that, that I was blessed by being in their presence. Under the most extreme conditions you could possibly imagine, they were still functioning. They were still trying to save people's lives.
By mid-afternoon, the 16 survivors of Stairwell B were out safe. But elsewhere in the debris field, the rescue of PAPD officers Will Jimeno and Sergeant John McLaughlin would continue for hours more. They were badly injured, trapped, and desperate to escape. At one point, Jimeno tried scraping the concrete around him with his handcuffs. For hours, they waited for someone to find them, uncertain if that person would ever come. The two ended up talking about life, their families, and their futures. At the time, the two men didn't even know each other's first names. And all the while, the world burned around them.
At one point, I said to the sergeant, put over the radio, please, if you could, that I want my wife to name the baby that we're expecting named Olivia. Me and Allison were kind of still trying to figure out the name, and she liked Olivia. I liked a couple other names, but I just wanted to make my wife happy because I didn't think we're coming out of there. He put it over his radio, which was nothing but static. He put a message over the radio for his family, and we continued to fight. But as night progressed, it got really, really bad.
Burning fuel started to trickle down toward them. Jimeno's forearm caught on fire. He was pinned and couldn't move and started batting his arm to try to put it out. Then the heat caught Pizzullo's gun. The remaining rounds in the service weapon began to cook off, firing off and ricocheting in the tightly enclosed cavern.
Remaining 15 rounds in his weapon fire above me, all I could do was take my hand, cover my face, and hope that, if a bullet hits my hand, it stops. But I knew better than that.
Jimeno thought this was it. The pressure from the concrete pinning him was starting something called compartment syndrome. His body began to swell and waves of pain shot across him.
And I remember just thinking to myself, that's it, we're going to die. So I took my hands and I make something I always did with my wife and my oldest daughter, Bianca, was I make in sign language the sign, I love you. And what I did was I took both my hands, made the I love you sign in sign language with both my hands and crossed them over my chest. Because I figured if I died and if they found me, they would tell Allison that that's how we found him.
By this point, Jimeno and Sergeant McLaughlin had been under the rubble for the entire day. The Sarge was in bad shape and deteriorating. The sun that poured through the hole above had faded. Then, around 8 p.m., in the quiet, terrifying darkness beneath the South Tower, Will heard yelling in the distance.
And at first I thought I was hallucinating, but then I started just yelling, PAPD officers down, and they said, we hear you, keep yelling. I actually started freaking out. I said, Sarge, there's people above us, and he's like, keep yelling at him. As they came closer, there was a hole above my left-hand side where they were using their flashlights to shine down, and I could see the flashlight actually on my left hand, and I kept yelling, hey, we're right here, and they're like, we're here, and I said, please don't leave us. They said, no, we're not going to leave you. We're Marines.
Not firefighters, not police, but two Marines, civilians by day, who had put on their camouflage fatigues and gone down to volunteer in Lower Manhattan. Just two of the many who flocked to the site to help that day. The men had started searching the wreckage themselves. And amazingly, amid the hellscape, it had been just quiet enough when they were just near enough to hear Jimeno's shouts.
Brave individuals that broke through the line when nobody was allowed. I thank them every day in my mind when I get up in the morning, as well as all the people that allowed me to be here today. But with their bravery is what ended up finding us, which I'm grateful for.
The men got the attention of NYPD emergency service officers and paramedics who started a valiant rescue effort.
They were ordered several times to leave us because there was an encroaching fire on top. And they said, no, we'll die with these guys.
It was a perilous process. The rescuers had little to work with in the tight space. And at one point, Jimeno urged them to amputate his trapped leg so that he could escape. But they decided against it, because all the rescuers had was a knife. Little by little, hour by hour, they made progress. Jimeno and Sergeant McLaughlin were eventually pulled from the rubble of the South Tower. Jimeno was rescued around midnight. As he surfaced atop a stretcher, he caught the first glimpse of the ruins above. Where is everything? He asked a firefighter. It's all gone, kid, the firefighter said. And for the first time in his ordeal that day, Jimeno cried. McLaughlin was rescued around 7 a.m. the following morning, the second to last person pulled from the rubble. Jimeno was taken to the hospital. There, he was surprised to see the crowds of nurses and doctors waiting for any survivor. The survivors who would never come. And when he realized he was it, for the second time that day, he cried. The days ahead were rough. He was intubated so that he could breathe while rocks and debris poured out from his lungs. And over the next few days, he flatlined twice. His wife and daughter were by his side. Police officers stood vigil at his bed. But Will couldn't speak through much of it. With his family, he remembers trying to use his hands to sign, I love you. But his hands were still too swollen.
So it was very difficult, and it took a lot of days before they pulled out the tube from my mouth And I was able to start speaking. And that's the first thing I said to Allison was, I love you. And the second thing was, I need to tell somebody what happened down there, what I saw.
Wilhelmetto's story of survival is incredible, but that's not why I'm sharing it. The most important part of his tale, to me, is what happened next. That experience of being in the worst place at the worst time changed how he looks at life. I got to know Will when I was working on my book about 9/11, and I've always been amazed at his perspective. His physical recovery was slow, and he struggled with what was originally undiagnosed PTSD. As he recovered, he began to speak, occasionally to small groups, like school children who were afraid to go on a plane after the attacks. He wanted to ease their fears, to explain the history of a day they'd been too young to understand.
I walked in, I told them the story about what happened, and I realized that I needed to share the good of that day, not the bad of that day. I talked about the bad of day because we can't, you know, sugarcoat things. Bad things happen, but a lot of good things happen.
Will told them the stories of strangers who stopped to help each other as they ran from the towers. He told them about the firefighters and police officers who ran toward the raging fires at the top of each building. And as he started sharing his own story, Will also started to understand the impact the attacks had had on him. His physical wounds had appeared to heal, but that recovery masked the fact that he was still traumatized. Will found himself getting angry at little things. One night, he exploded at his brother-in-law over a tray of eggplant parmesan. Another night, it was his wife and the TV remote. That night, he terrified himself so much that he left the house, drove his truck to a wildlife area, and sat until he calmed down. When he returned home, he went upstairs to his oldest daughter's room.
And I remember walking upstairs to my daughter's room, Bianca, my oldest, and I said, Bianca, does Daddy yell a lot? She goes, yeah, Daddy, sometimes you scare us. And I said, no, I can't do that.
Will started seeing a therapist and was diagnosed finally with post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD in some ways has become the defining injury of the war on terror that began 20 years ago that Tuesday. Thousands of Americans died that day and thousands more in the two wars that the attacks launched. But many, many more have been devastated by the PTSD of that day and the ensuing combat. Will was one of the first PTSD victims of the war on terror, but he was hardly the last. Some 4 million Americans have fought in the post-9/11 wars, and a 2019 Pew study found that roughly half of those veterans say that they had emotionally traumatic or distressing experiences related to their military service. A third say that they sought professional help to deal with those experiences and that trauma. Those mental and moral wounds have contributed to a national epidemic of veteran suicide. About 7,000 military personnel have died overseas in combat, but 30,000 veterans of that war on terror have committed suicide. Jimeno was determined to not become one himself. This summer, he released a book, Sunrise Through the Darkness, and in it, he says, each time I faced up to a mistake, it felt like I was taking ownership of my life away from PTSD. The first time we ever spoke, he told me, the day I beat PTSD will be the day that I'm laid in the ground. But he's learned along the way to manage it. He's learned to live again. Ultimately, Will has come to understand that he wasn't defined by the building that fell on him. Instead, he would be defined by what he did in spite of it. Now, he is an author and motivational speaker. But Will doesn't speak to fancy corporate gigs in exotic Caribbean resorts. Instead, he goes to places where people need help. Will talks to support groups, rehab patients, jail inmates, military recruits, police academies, middle, high school, and college students. He helps people who face a struggle now or will in the future. Will's main message to these audiences is that trauma isn't comparative or competitive. And the one thing sure about life is that we're all going to face some trauma. It's what we do when our towers fall and who we become when we escape from under them that matters most.
People always come up to me and they say, Will, I can't think of anything worse than the World Trade Center falling on you. 220 stories. Whatever tragic event is happening in your life, it's at that moment you have your own World Trade Center. It's what we do with ourselves to overcome those challenges. And that's why I tell people, if you're going to look at my story or our story, as I like to refer to it, look at it that this individual, two individuals were not supposed to come out from underneath these immense towers, but they did. And they've been able to somehow, some way find happiness. Those lessons is what I want to teach people today, that no matter what your World Trade Center is, you can learn to live with that and you can live a good life.
Jay Jonas learned to live with it too. September 11th, 2001 was his last mission as captain of Ladder 6. That day, across the city, the Fire Department of New York was devastated. 343 firefighters were killed, including two paramedics, its chaplain Michael Judge, and a fire marshal, Ronald Buca. The FDNY's chief, its rescue chief, and the first deputy commissioner died that day too. More than 90 units lost at least one firefighter that day. Jimeno's department, the PAPD, lost 37 officers, as well as the head of the police academy, who had trained Jimeno just months before. 23 NYPD officers were also killed on September 11th. A dozen other first responders died, including private ambulance and fire services, FBI and Secret Service agents, New York court officers, and more. The toll, sadly, has continued to rise due to the diseases and cancers that grew out of the rescue efforts. First responders breathed in a toxic stew of chemicals and poisons from what later would become known as Ground Zero. As of 9/11's 20th anniversary, more first responders have died from ailments related to the rescue than to the collapse itself. Immediately after the attack, on the morning of Wednesday, September 12th, the FDNY began to rebuild, and Jay Jonas became a fixture in that future. Less than a week later, he was promoted to battalion chief, the equivalent of a battlefield promotion he never would have wanted. Today, Jonas has close to 42 years with the FDNY and still works in the Bronx. Like many others in the past 20 years, Jonas has also struggled with stress and anxiety after September 11th. But he says it goes away when he's back in his element fighting fires. He's never really thought about leaving the job. He and the other members of Ladder 6 stayed close with Josephine Harris, the woman they rescued from the North Tower. They called her their guardian angel. If they hadn't stopped to save her, they wouldn't have been in the one part of the North Tower that survived the building's collapse. They'd stopped to save her, but she ended up saving them. Harris was interviewed by Randall Sullivan on the Oprah Winfrey Network in 2011.
So what kind of a bond do you and the members of that ladder company?
Ladder 6?
Ladder 6 have
today.
Oh,
those are my brothers.
Are they?
Oh, yeah. I got six beautiful, bad firefighters for brothers.
What about being in Stairwell B that day? What do you think about that?
It was just something that was meant to happen.
Does that make it a miracle?
To me, it does.
Unfortunately, Harris never got to see that interview air. She died of a heart attack the night it was broadcast. Jay Jonas was devastated when he found out. He said it was like losing a family member.
She died January 15th of 2011. She had a heart attack, and her last act on this earth was to call the fire department. So she called the fire department. They did CPR on her, and they couldn't bring her back. The first I heard about this was a couple days later. Her body was not claimed yet. So, she had a sister, and she was not going to have a funeral for her. She was just going to have a memorial service. She couldn't afford a funeral.
The firefighters of Ladder 6 started calling around looking for donations. They wanted to scrape something together to put their friend to rest. That's when the owner of a Greenwich Village funeral home got in touch. He'd heard about Ladder 6's story in the New York Times and wanted to pay for Harris's funeral.
And he went top shelf. You know, he got a custom-made casket and had the wake at the funeral home. And the next day was the funeral, and it was a miserable day in Manhattan. We had about 8 inches of snow. And the guys who were trapped with her, other guys from Ladder 6, were pallbearers. And we carried the casket up the steps of St. Joseph's Church. You know, there was, with such a miserable day, they had to be 100 off-duty firemen in their dress uniforms in the church. And the cardinal said in his homily, he says, "I love firemen. I love firemen. And it's not because of the courage that you show every day. It's for your compassion." He says, "You never forgot about this woman."
Never forget. That's the mantra that our nation has lived by now for 20 years. The challenge to keep the memory of 9/11 alive. To remember the fallen. To remember how our country, our world, and our lives were changed on that bright, blue, cloudless September Tuesday. And it's that challenge and a mission that survivors like Jay Jonas and Will Gimeno live every day. Long Shadow has been a production of Goat Rodeo and Long Lead. Don't forget to leave us a rating and a review. It helps spread the word about the show. I'm your host, Garrett Graff. Long Shadow's lead producer is Max Johnston. The show was written by me, Garrett Graff, with co-writing from Max and Long Shadow's executive producer, John Patrick Pullen. Story editing from Morgan Springer. Editorial support by Dan Eisner, Diana Albasha, and Owen O'Carroll. Senior producers at Goat Rodeo are Megan Nadolsky and Ian Enright. Rebecca Seidel is managing producer. Series assistants from Isabel Kirby McGowan, Hamza Shittu, and Kara Schillen. Music and sound design by Max Johnston, Blue Dot Sessions, and Ian Enright. Podcast artwork by Emily Crawford. Long Lead's creative director is Natalie Matuszewski.